Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And there's a term for this. It's called declining baselines, and this happens everywhere, which is that if you get used to some diminished situation, that diminished situation now becomes your new normal, and they can continue to push it further then once it's normalized. And we see this everywhere.
That's the voice of prolific author Derek Jensen. In this program, we speak with Derek Jensen about male violence against women and the politics of consent. We're very privileged to have Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen is a wonderful environmental activist. He's also a prolific writer. His many books include Endgame, The Derek Jensen Reader, The Knitting Circle, The Rapist Annihilation Squad, Earth at Risk, The Culture of Make Believe, Deep Green Resistance, and his very latest, Earth at Risk. We're very privileged to have him with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
One of the things that most inspires me about your work is the way you make what seems to be a very complicated mythology about what our culture is and, you know, how inevitable this culture of violence is. You simply break it apart and reveal, you know, the myth within it, but also the way we collectively resist and join in imagining ourselves as part of the living world and creating coexistence. So I want to begin our conversation by perhaps talking a little bit about the culture of violence that defines the Western civilization and the idea of civilization and as industrialized production at any cost. When we think of violation, we often think of someone's rights being, trespassed. For me as a woman, I think of rape. I think of the way in which our bodies as women have been defiled and, you know, conceive as property or as objects for pleasure, the multitude of ways in which we are violated. So can we begin by talking about the silencing that is necessary in this culture to maintain this culture of domination, this culture of violence?
Okay. Well, it's pretty funny. There's this quote that I've loved for a long time by Milan Kundera that is, the struggle against oppression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And we can talk about that for a second, but the thing I find really interesting at this moment is I just learned about 6 months ago that I've been misquoting that for years. And it ends up that what he said was, the struggle of man against oppression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And they got some silencing right there, you know. It's like, hello, what about women? What about anybody else? So we even have it right there, and it happens on every level, from rationalizing that the others don't exist, that they are, you know, not subjective beings. I'm talking about non-humans, or frankly, women, or Africans, or others. And there's a quote that I've done a lot by a Portuguese explorer talking about Africans, saying, when they speak, they fart with their tongues in their mouths. And the point is, they didn't speak Portuguese, and so they clearly did not speak, and therefore they were inferior, therefore violable, and therefore enslavable. The next book I'm going to work on, I just finished a book this last week, and the next book I work on is probably going to be a book on human supremacism, which I think is one of the biggest problems facing us today. I mean, it's the same pattern, whether we're talking about male supremacism or white supremacism or human supremacism. It ends up that a lot of the same tactics are used, same strategies are used. And sort of to cut to the core of it, there's a couple things. One is, my first major book, A Language of Women's Words, was supposed to be this really happy description of interspecies communication. And it was going to be basically around the question, can non-humans communicate or can't they? And trying to show that they really can, and showing examples of how non-humans have sentience and have the ability to communicate. I mean, we now know that prairie dogs have grammar, and they've got best friends. And, I mean, it's not a real big surprise. And cows have best friends. And there's increasing discussion of the intelligence of plants and fungi. And it's long been clear to me that pretty much everybody is sentient and everybody is communicating. But leaving that aside, at the time I was writing, I was like, okay, how do I write this book? And I talk about all the stories of people having conversations with their dogs, which can be very simple, of, you know, the dog's water bowl is empty, so how does the dog communicate that to you? You know, look at the water dish, look at you, look at the water dish, until finally you get it. And for years, it was very interesting, if I went to my mom's and then I was going to take a walk from there, the dogs would be sitting on her porch. I'd walk over there, and then the dogs would be sitting on her porch. If I went for a walk, they'd go with me. But if I walked outside and I was going to go get in my car, they would lift up their head, but they wouldn't get up off the porch. And it took me years to figure out what they'd figured out right away, which is if I have keys in my hand, I'm getting in the car, so don't bother getting up. And my point is, it took me years to figure that out, and they figured it out right away. Or another way to put all this is, it's always kind of astounded me that, you know, they talk about whether, you know, these apes are really learning sign language or whether they're just mimicking, which of course is how humans learn language too, we'll leave that aside. They'll talk about, gosh, is that really language when the ape learns and all this stuff? But nobody ever asks the question, it's like, which of these creatures is bilingual? You know, the ape is learning a human language, and I don't see these scientists learning ape. And simultaneously, if a bunch of apes were to kidnap some scientists and put them in ape versions of mobile homes and try to teach them their language, how quickly would the scientists catch on? You know, it's just, there's the arrogance inherent in all of this. There's presumption that the other is an object until proven otherwise. And then the next thing I want to say about all this is one of my favorite lines I ever wrote was in the Culture of Make-Believe, and it was that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like economics or religion or science or just the way things are. And what I mean by that is when we think of hate, we think of, you know, sort of like right-wing buffoons wearing, you know, KKK robes and shouting white power. But that's not really... I'll back up a second. When I first started to write Culture Make-Believe, I was asking, it was supposed to be a 5-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And I asked the question, what's a hate group? And I went to a KKK website, and they said, well, we're not a hate group, we're a love group because we love whites. I was like, okay, so either A, the KKK is not a hate group, or B, we can't trust rhetoric. Well, if you can't trust rhetoric, what do you trust? And the thing is, if you go just by the numbers, then the biggest racist, segregationist organization in the country is the U.S. judicial and penal system, because it achieves segregation of African-American males on a scale the KKK can only dream of. And so it quickly became clear to me that just asking what is hate, you know, sort of picking on hate groups, as hateful as they are, is really just taking the most superficial ones. If you want for people to consider women as inferior, why don't you, instead of just saying, hey, I'm a dude and I think that women are inferior, instead get your god, who happens to be a dude, by the way, to write how women are supposed to be subservient. And then, especially if you can get the women to buy into it, you know, you've got most of your work done. Because another thing about this is that we have to remember that 99% of any oppression is essentially consensual, by which I mean that a couple things. One of them is that the oppressors never have enough people that they can stand around and police all of the oppressed at every moment. So what you really have to do is to get the oppressed to somehow philosophically or theologically or scientifically buy into their own oppression, to believe that this oppression is natural. And there's another way to say this, which is there's a saying in the battered women's movement that one good beating lasts a year. That, you know, if the beating is severe enough, you only have to do it once a year, because the other 364 days, they're going to give consent. And but that, once again, is sort of the straight-out authoritarian model for gaining consent. And it's more congenial to your own conscience and also more efficient if you can get them, get the oppressed to buy into it, to believe that your authority is somehow natural. And if you want, we can talk about how this plays out in patriarchy, racism, human supremacism, capitalism, but it's essentially in many ways the same story. You try to come up with a theoretical rationalization for why your oppression of this other is either good or natural or inherent or appropriate. You know, another way to say all this is that old line by Harriet Tubman that, you know, I freed hundreds of slaves, and I could have freed hundreds more if only they had known they were slaves.
Wow.
That's great from the oppressor's perspective. What you really want is to have the slaves not realize they're slaves.
You know, that's the important part, I think, because I don't know that I would call it consent, since I feel that my so-called consent is being forced upon me by violence, by the beatings, by the economic inequality that I'm exposed to, by the crippling poverty and poverty that I'm, you know, forced to live with. So can we talk a little bit about then how does this so-called reciprocal acceptance of violence takes root in a community?
Well, I want to, can we back up a second and talk about the word consent for a moment?
Yes, please.
Because I completely hear what you're saying, and I don't use the word consent as a positive word. You know, I just mentioned, you know, that I finished the book that I'm working on, or the book that I was working on, was a book about some of the things that are wrong with anarchism. And one of the things I want to mention here is that there's strong support amongst some strains of anarchism for example, pedophilia. And both major U.S. anarchist magazines have been staunchly and militantly pro-pedophile. And there's a couple major anarchist philosophers who are openly pro-pedophile. And people are not, anarchists are not attacking them for this pedophilia. And one of the arguments that the pro-pedophile, and there's also a lot of really strong misogyny within anarchism. Those are a couple of things I hit pretty hard. But anyway, the point is that the watchword of a lot of the pedophilia and misogyny is, oh, we only have, for pedophilia, it would be, we only want to have sex with consenting children. But I want to tell a story about that, which is, when I was 24, I was living in a small town in Nevada, and one day my brother-in-law was going to go to the dump. So I asked if I wanted to go. I said, sure. So my brother-in-law gets in. He sits on the left. My 4-year-old niece sits on the seat between us. My 6-year-old niece sits on my left leg, and a friend of hers sat on my right leg. And, you know, I had babysat enough, and I also had, you know, little nieces that I took care of quite a bit. And so I know what it's like to have a kid sit on my lap. And I know what it's like to have a kid play with your hands. My 6-year-old niece's friend, when she sat, she squirmed around and then squared her crotch on my leg such that I could feel her genitals through her shorts on my thigh. And she was also playing with my hand in a very sexual way. And at the time, I was too naive to know exactly what was going on, but I just knew this was really creepy, and so I shifted her so that she couldn't do that anymore. And then we went to the dump and did all that stuff and went back, and I don't remember how we saw on the way back, but I didn't say anything because I was so young and naive that I didn't know what it meant. I just knew it was really creepy. So I didn't say anything to everybody else. But here's the point, is that about a few weeks later, it broke all through the town that this little girl was being raped by her big brother. And had I known, of course, that this was a sign that she was being sexually abused, I would have said something first. But the point is that I learned that that sort of behavior is really typical acting out. And my point having to do with the anarchism is that that would have been considered consent. But that's not really consent. That was having been groomed. And so a lot of the point of oppression is to take various ways to groom people into consent and groom people into participation. Judith Herman, who wrote the wonderful and absolutely necessary Trauma and Recovery, talks about how when pimps, for example, break women, trying to turn them into prostitute women, and this is true for standard abuse too, you know, they do many horrible things, but the thing that really breaks the person's spirit is when they can get them to violate their own moral code seemingly consensually, when they get them to participate. Like, that's really one of the major steps in the degradation. Once again, the anarchists are huge on the word consent, but it's okay to do pornography as long as the woman signs a consent form. That means she's participating, which is all just nuts given everything is around it. And the point here is that I don't even think consent is the appropriate word when we're talking about two people who love each other, who want to make love. I mean, it's just nuts. If you look in the dictionary under the word consent, one of the examples it will give is he consented to a search by a detective. And it's like, you know, is that the attitude you want with somebody that's going to have sex with you? They're consenting with the same eagerness with which they'd consent to being searched by a cop? Like, no. So for me, consent is not a positive word. And consent, I would never use that word about sexuality. What I want in sexuality is, you know, wild enthusiasm, you know, or joy. And so when I'm talking about consent, I'm saying that it means that you have taken some role, however unwilling, that you have gone ahead and participated. And that's not a terrible thing. I mean, it can also be, you know, honestly, you know, my mom is getting pretty old and she loves the garden and I frankly don't like weeding and I will consent to weed. And so it's okay, but that doesn't mean she's oppressing me in that case. That just means I'm, you know, sort of trudging along, oh, okay, I'll weed. So consent doesn't have to mean oppression, but my point is that consent is never enthusiastic. Does that make sense?
That's a beautiful way to describe it, because I think it leads us into what you really alluded to earlier, is the grooming of oppression, the kinds of cultural, religious, economic, militaristic, corrosive violence that is used to groom us into believing that this is the way things are and the common sense things to, you know, simply adjust, accommodate to it. Can we talk a little bit, though, about those who do the grooming? Because in some way, if we are in this relationship and this, in order for it to become the norm, it needs to be participant by both the oppressor and the oppressed. How does that relationship then evolve?
I think that there are multiple ways this can happen, and I want to talk about at least two ways. And if I'm misunderstanding your question, please let me know, and I'll go a different direction. But I think of two ways, and I'm going to talk about them on a personal level, and then I'm going to talk about them on a social level. And one way, there's of course an infinite number of ways it can happen, but I want to talk about two sort of contrasting ways. And one way is where it's just overtly authoritarian, and the control is through outright terror. You know, a great example of that would be some young person or some woman being kidnapped and beaten by pimps and forced. And that's pretty much outright terror, a lot of it. We can talk about that in terms of military policy, too. At the frontier of empire, it's often just overt, straightforward, if you don't do it, we're going to kill you. And think about the consent that would have happened, for example, within the camps, the death camps and work camps in Nazi Germany, that, you know, they didn't really bother with any of the niceties. They would give tiny rewards sometimes, but a lot of it was just, if you don't do it, I'll kill you. And there's that form to get people to consent, because obviously, using my definition from a moment ago, you know, they were consenting, which doesn't mean that they were joyful, doesn't mean anything. It means they knew, if I don't do this, they'll kill me. And then there's another form, too, which has to do with, it's more sophisticated, and smarter abusers know this. Smarter abusers know that you can't be an abuser at every moment, that you have to mix in rewards. And the really smart ones save the abuse for special occasions when it's necessary to reinforce. And we can talk about this in terms of domestic violence, in terms of, you know, there's a beating, but then there's the chocolate, there's the whole makeup, and there's the honeymoon period. I mean, that's really stereotypical. And then also, we can talk about this on Lewis Mumford's level, on a larger social scale, where Lewis Mumford talks about how one of the big differences between modern autocratic regimes and or authoritarian regimes, and he's talking about, for example, the United States or any of the so-called democratic regimes, how they're actually more sophisticated, because what they do is they offer what he calls a magnificent bribe, which is that you can have as much as you want of everything the system offers as long as you don't ask for anything that the system doesn't offer. So in the United States, this is absolutely brilliant. I mean, most of the people in the United States have, even the poor, many of them have, in some ways, extravagant luxuries. They got hot showers every day, you know, if they're not homeless. And they've got access to, you know, who knows how many channels on TV, and they've got access to the Internet, probably, and so they can have lots of ways to keep themselves distracted. And they can buy 17 different flavors of potato chips and 35 different types of ice cream. There was this pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s who was writing about how necessary slavery was to civilization from the very beginning, and he was arguing why that they should not emancipate slaves. And it was that his bottom line basically boiled down to, you can't have the comforts and elegancies for the rich without having the poor build them. Back then, they were much less sophisticated in delivery, because then he was acknowledging that you have to have slavery to have the comforts and elegancies, and nowadays we all sort of presume that they magically appear in the grocery store, you know? That the iPad or the laptop computer suddenly magically appears at your door when you order it online without thinking about all the misery that went into it. We somehow have been able to buy into Mumford's magnificent bribe enough that not only do we not ask where it comes from, but we also forget that we can't ask for what was not offered. So we can ask for 75 different types of laptop computer, but we can't ask for the 75 types of dragonfly who used to be living. I'm sitting outside looking at a pond, and, you know, they're used to, even 8 years ago, at this time of year, I would see in the sky probably, I would easily see 50 or 100 dragonflies, and I'm seeing probably 15. So long as you only ask, which is a form of that consent, you bought into it enough that you no longer think about it. It's like the frogs used to be just a few years ago, so loud that you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night, and that's really diminished. And I was asking some guy who's not an environmentalist, who lives in, you know, within, I don't know, maybe a half mile of me, I said, this was a couple years ago, I said, so have you noticed the frogs collapsing? He said, no, I had no idea. I was like, the only way you can have no idea is if you never went outside at night. And there's a term for this. It's called declining baselines, and this happens everywhere, which is that if you get used to some diminished situation, that diminished situation now becomes your new normal, and they can continue to push it further then once it's normalized. And we see this everywhere, whether it is in surveillance, where I read about in the 1930s, some people were freaking out about even having a social security number because it would follow you from cradle to grave. And now, you know, they're of course recording every phone call and every email. And I keep thinking of this one Doobie Brothers album title, which was What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits, and how that happened. Even 10 years ago or 11 years ago or something, I wrote a book with George Drafin called Welcome to the Machine, and one of the things we talked about in there were these strange new things called predator drones. And, you know, now it's pretty normalized. And give it a little bit longer, and people won't even think about it. And this happens within abusive relationships, too, where if you're a really smart abuser, you don't generally start off with smashing them in the head. What you do is you slowly up the repression so that the person doesn't balk at each new slight incremental decrease of their freedom and of the richness of their lives. And that's one of the ways that we all get sucked into this. And it's all carrot and stick. We get the stick of beatings or simply disapproval or whatever, and we get the carrot of Mumford's Magnificent Bribe. One day last fall, I was at my mom's, and it was just this wonderful visitation by lots of animals. And I see, you know, yesterday I saw a bear in this pond, and I see animals around here all the time. But one day last fall, it was almost like a French farce where one animal would show up and another one around one side of the tree while another one would go around the other side. And there was, like, bears, and then there was possums, and then there was foxes, and then there was more bears, and there was possums, and everybody, and raccoons, and everybody's just showing up. And I was really excited about that until I remembered something the next day that I had read a while earlier, which is that in this part of the country, before contact, before conquest, you could plan on, if you're sitting near a river, you could plan on seeing a grizzly bear every 15 minutes. So prior to this culture doing what it does, I would have seen more grizzly bears in that same time than I saw of all these animals put together. And that's just one species. And so my point is, we see this all the time in a really tangible way.
Tune in next week for the second part of Violence Against Women and the Politics of Consent. Thanks. Bye for now. We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.